Hey, it's Joe. I don't know about you, but I'm worried about working very hard to retain a fit body, only to be undone by a future unraveled mind. I've seen it happen. I bet you have too. What I want to know is how much risk do I have, given my genetic background, my lifestyle, and unfortunately, concussions that I've had over the years. And what can I do to keep that terrible outcome at bay? If dementia is something that you worry about, then listen in as I chat with big brain Amanda Wiggins, neuroscience PhD, to discuss avoiding dementia for the older athlete. Heck, we all know staying active is good for our bodies, but what about our brains? What we want to know is what are the smart strategies that can help us protect our cognitive health while still pursuing athletic performance. All right, let's talk to Amanda Wiggins about bridging the gap between athletic longevity and brain longevity. Amanda Wiggins, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Hey, Joe. Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, we've had some trouble getting together on this, but finally we're doing this. I've secretly been kind of worried about this topic, and I'm glad to finally get an expert here on the show to illuminate this for me. You know, how big of a risk is this? You know, what could I do to minimize it? Things like that. So, wow, thanks very much.
Yeah, great to be here. So, I'm really keen to talk about, you know, changes people can make in their lifestyle to reduce their risk of dementia, developing dementia later in life. And there's a really excellent study that came out last year that's pretty hard-hitting, and it shows that if you address these 14 so-called modifiable risk factors in your life, you can reduce your risk of developing dementia by a massive 45%. So I think that's worth talking about, and that's why I contacted you to have a chat.
Fantastic. Well, yeah, 45% is pretty good. Heck, I'd like to reduce it down even further than that. So I'm going to be all ears and wanting to know what these things are. And my guess is that some of these things are going to be the same as just being a healthy person, which I'm already trying as hard as I can to do. But I bet not all of them are. I mean, I have a history of having concussions. So not doing that is important, probably. There's the APOE4 thing, which nobody can control, but knowing that you have it. Anyway, there's this like scorecard idea of, hey, you know, how could we like tell how risky we are individually for this? Is it family history? Is it genetic profile? Is it history of injuries? Anything like that would be useful for to say, you know, for you few people, you really have got to do it perfectly from here on out.
Well, you know, dementia is like any disease, really. It's quite complex in terms of how it starts and how it progresses. So it's not just genes, it's not just environment. It seems to be a combination of everything, of lifestyle. And what we know now is that the earliest biochemical changes in the brain that lead into dementia start in the middle of life. So somewhere around sort of 30 or 40, isn't that awful to think? Not something that was known 20 years ago, but it is known now that those earliest kind of pathological changes occurring in the brain start right in the middle phase of life. So, you know, what I'd love to see is an easy diagnostic that can pick up those early changes, say in your 40s, so you can then do everything humanly possible to slow that progression. I know that there is a bit of work going on around blood tests. How long they take to come to market, I don't know. Oh, actually, that's not true. One FDA-approved blood test for detecting dementia was approved earlier this year, but it can only detect the earliest stages, not the the lead-up.
I see. So it's once you've got it.
Yeah. So you had to have the earliest stages of dementia to use this blood test. That's great though, right? But what I'd love to see is a test that comes out that can detect it in your 40s. And sure. Then you can be really, really, really proactive in addressing the risk factors. There is actually one report in the literature of a clinician's who says they actually reversed a case of Alzheimer's disease. Now, that's obviously been met with quite a lot of skepticism. It was sort of intensive, you know, exercise, dietary and lifestyle interventions, and the disease was apparently reversed. But I don't think many doctors actually believe that that's true. But it certainly, you know, seems possible to me. And this is where I think the biggest hope lies, that if we had an early detection system and married up with intensive lifestyle interventions, you know, maybe it could become a reversible disease. That's what I'd love to see.
Yeah, well, that would be great. I guess in the meantime, people like me want to know, well, what should I do or not do in order to keep my chance of getting it or delay my getting it, you know, as well as I possibly can. So I thought we would start with, tell me what you think about this outline, that we'd start with, you know, what is it, this dementia thing? And I'm assuming that it's more like a list of symptoms that you have when you have it. Maybe there is some you do an image of the brain and maybe the brain is shrunk in certain ways. And, you know, there's some physical evidence of it beyond the behavioral aspects of it. And then if we could talk about maybe, you know, for somebody like me, because I don't think I have dementia, you know, fingers crossed, that, you know, what are the early warning signs like you were talking about? Maybe there aren't tests, but maybe there are some known clinical signs of it, or maybe it's just lifestyle things that you've been doing your whole life and that has put you at higher risk, or maybe family history or things like that. And then we could talk about, well, what can we do? You know, what are these lifestyle things and maybe other things that we can do to, you know, not have this terrible thing? You know, I mean, if I hurt my knee and I can't run, that's a bummer. That's really bad. I'd be really sorry about that. But if I lose myself, well, I'm dead. You know, even if I'm not, my heart is still beating, I'm not me anymore. And that is a really scary thought. So I totally don't want this thing. What do you think about that outline? Anything to take away or add?
That sounds great. So, yeah, I guess we could just kick off by talking about what is dementia. And so dementia is actually an umbrella term. I think there's something like over 100 different types of dementia, with Alzheimer's disease being the most common, followed by vascular dementia. So dementia is really defined as cognitive decline that is severe enough to impact your daily life. We all have cognitive decline, actually, after the age of about 45. But for most of us, it's not severe enough to impact our daily life. Dementia is characterized by being progressive, you know, chronic, and the underlying pathophysiology, all of them are slightly different, but the key is that they all have damage to brain cells, and that's what really impairs our ability to, you know, think and remember. It affects emotions as well. So each of the different types of dementia does have a slightly different brain pathology associated with it. And I think, Joe, you know, you asked, you know, what are the tests or the signs and symptoms? You know, here in New Zealand, we tend to, well, the way that dementia is diagnosed is just through cognitive tests. We don't do brain scans here. It's mostly because we don't have that many brain scanners in New Zealand. We've only got a few. But generally, it's post-death that it is really properly determined if there's, you know, someone takes a look at the brain. You know, I think when it comes to, you know, a person's risk, it is a complex set of things that occurs throughout a person's life. And the study that I think is the most interesting is this Lancet Commission report that was published in 2024. So the Lancet Commission is a multi-sector group of individuals who are all specialists in dementia. It was brought together in 2017 by Professor Jill Livingston, and they did their first report on dementia in 2020 and their second report in 2024, which was essentially an update on the earlier one. The 2024 report identified 14 so-called modifiable risk factors, and I think most of your listeners would know what a modifiable risk factor is. It means it's something you can modify, which alters your risk profile of developing dementia later, and that's in contrast to something that's not modifiable, like someone's genetic makeup, like the APOE gene that you mentioned earlier.
Okay, well, give me some examples of, you know, a person who has dementia and their brain function has diminished enough that it's now affecting their life. What does that mean? You said that it can affect their emotions, but it, like, maybe they forget. I mean, that's sort of the classic thing where it's like, I forgot, I can't remember where I put my keys. Oh my gosh, I have dementia. What are these symptoms?
Yes, for me, it's finding my glasses. I get in a lot of extra steps every day looking for my glasses.
Right.
You know, that is actually a very normal part of aging, just forgetting where you park the car or forgetting where you put your keys or your glasses. I mean, I've even occasionally put the TV remote in a weird place like the fridge and you think, oh my God, is this it? No, this is not it. You're okay. You're totally fine. You know, in this modern era, we are so bombarded with messages, people, social media. So I'm probably standing there talking to the kids, also checking Facebook, and I accidentally put the remote in the fridge. That's just because my brain can't function, it can't focus on all those tasks at one time. It doesn't mean I'm becoming, you know, in the early stages of having dementia. There's been a lot of work recently on what are the earliest telltale signs that someone might have dementia, and there's some really interesting things coming out. Loss of smell seems to be one of the earlier senses that someone loses. Also, cadence of speech. So, you know, we all struggle to find words occasionally.
Yeah. It's on the tip of my tongue. I can't think of it.
Yeah. What was that word? And for me, I find it, for some reason, it's just worse in the morning. So right here in New Zealand, it's 21 minutes past 9 in the morning. It's not that early, but it's still early enough that my brain is still essentially waking up, right? And there is, you know, it's a really measurable problem that happens to women when they go through menopause. They forget words. Can really affect their professional performance and whatnot. So what research has shown that it's not the forgetting of words or being unable to locate a word, it's actually the cadence, the speed that someone speaks that's a stronger indicator of them being likely to develop dementia later in life. So really, really slow way of speaking. Isn't that interesting?
So slow is better or worse?
Slow speaking is more associated with developing dementia later as opposed to people who speak fast.
Okay.
And the other real hallmark, so, you know, the forgetting where you put something or you know, forgetting why you got in the car or why you went into a room, say, all completely normal. What is not normal is confusion around everyday things. So, for example, if I can't remember where I put my glasses, I walk into my bedroom, I see my glasses, and I freak out because I think it's something else, like I think it's a fox in my house, say, that would be a real sign that there's a problem and you need to go see your doctor. So just the forgetting where you put your glasses, all normal. Thinking it's something else, really not normal. Yeah, if your loved one asks you to pass the salt and pepper and you get up and go to your handbag and get your credit card out, say, really good example. A common thing with early dementia is not knowing whether it's night or day. People with early stage dementia might go down into town to go to the supermarket in the middle of the night and can't work out why it's not open. Where is everyone? That type of thing. Okay. So confusion as opposed to just a bit of memory loss is probably the number one hallmark to look out for.
All right. Well, so that's interesting. You had mentioned this report with 12 or 14 modifiable risk factors, and that kind of falls into this category of what I was interested in, which is what can we do? And I'm not sure the order you wanted to go in, but more and more, I think we are understanding that brain health is just a part of being a healthy person, right? If you have metabolic health, right? If you have high blood sugar, well, that's not just bad for your cardiovascular disease, you know, it's also bad for your brain. You know, if you've got high blood pressure, that's not going to just be bad for killing your kidney. That's going to be bad for your brain. And, you know, so all of these things that we already know that we should be watching out for and doing better on, they're also important for our brain health, but not everything. Like you mentioned, the sense of smell goes away. But I have heard that, you know, things like if you lose your hearing, you really do need to get that taken care of, like get a hearing aid, because when you lose sensory input to the brain is now starved of stimulation. It's like a not lifting weights with your muscles, and your body, it'll go away if you're not using it. So anyway, walk us through what some of these things are that we can do. And then I want to get into this question of how could I assess my own personal risk?
Mm. Oh, you're so right, Joe, that you're absolutely hit the nail on the head that a lot of just being healthy also directly feeds into having a healthy brain. The issue we have in our brain is that it is A, very energy intensive, right? It's like the supercomputer center that needs a lot of energy supply, a lot of blood supply. So any interruption to that system, whether it's high blood pressure or high blood sugar or other things, is more catastrophic in the brain than it is in other organs. So that's really the problem. And also our brain cells, we actually do retain the ability to grow new brain cells as we age, although that ability does decline with age. But we're not very good at that versus, you know, a torn muscle or whatever. We can regrow that. Kidneys are actually quite good at regenerating, so is the liver, so are muscles. Mm. Brain can happen, but not so efficient and not so good. So that's really the reason that I think the brain is just more sensitive to these perturbations in health status than other organs. Mm. So, yes, the report, yay. We get to talk about this very, very exciting report, the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention and Care, Treatment and Care. Published in 2024. So as I said, this was an update to an earlier report. The earlier report identified 12 modifiable risk factors, and the new report identified an extra two, taking it to 14. The extra two were vision loss and high cholesterol. So what's interesting about this report is it's a meta-analysis. So I don't know if your listeners be familiar with that, but a meta-analysis is where you pull together all of the super high quality data, and it gives you a massive statistical advantage in analyzing data. Essentially, you know, when you do one study, you have that statistical power of that study, which might be 100 people or 1,000 people. When you do a meta-analysis, the way you bring all the data in together is very, very controlled. So to take out any crap data or crap studies that aren't well controlled, you pull it all together so you have massive statistical power. So it's a very, very powerful technique, but it also can't pick up, or it doesn't, it won't recognize when there's a small study like the creatine study that just had a small number of people and wasn't properly controlled. So it's great because it's powerful, but it doesn't pick up the smaller stuff, right?
Okay.
This study takes a life course view. So it goes through the different stages of life from, you know, childhood through to middle age through to the senior years, and picks up the 14 modifiable risk factors, which when combined together, account for approximately 45% of a person's risk of developing dementia later.
All right.
So in the early stage of life, more education is associated with a reduced risk of developing dementia.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Why do you think that is? Is it because the brain doesn't develop as well if you have less education when you're young?
Yeah, I think the jury is out a wee bit on that. We don't exactly know, but they like to attribute it to something they call cognitive reserve. So cognitive reserve is really means how many connections we have, mm-hmm. right? So we've got hundreds of millions of brain cells up there and billions of connections between them. And it's really the connections that are the most important thing. So if some brain cells die, the brain cells that are still alive can connect to other brain cells and pick up some, if not all, of the function that was lost through the death of those other brain cells, right? And so with the more you use your brain through things like education, the more connections you're going to have. And that's what's called cognitive reserve. So you're more connected.
Like me building up my muscles while I can before I'm so old that it's very hard to build up my muscles. And then I have more to lose so I can go further with more muscle mass and maybe better metabolic health. So it's kind of a similar idea.
Yeah. It's like bodybuilding for your brain.
Yeah. Does it work into adulthood? I mean, I'm not growing anymore. Can I still like learn another language and build some cognitive reserve?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what keeping your brain active through middle life and beyond is all about, cognitive reserve, connections, keeping those Fantastic. Connections between the brain cells growing. So doing something new, maintaining that mental activity is very, very important and from middle life and beyond.
Okay. Anyway, sorry I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I just think, you know, when you get into that stage of having a family, you actually go into a state of being sort of less cognitively stimulated often, right? When you've got small children particularly, it becomes very routine. You're usually mostly just kind of staying home and doing washing and putting babies to bed and all that. So I don't know. I think for women there's even more impetus to really get stuck into some cognitively stimulating activities when the kids are old enough and you've got less childcare to do.
Right. I mean, just like people want to take care of their bones, you know, doing impact or, you know, diet and that sort of thing so that you don't have sarcopenia or that's muscles, but osteoporosis when you're older. It's the same thing with your brain. Get your brain as healthy as you can when you can, and then you'll be a healthier person, brain, bone, muscle, the older you get.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so some of the things that were identified in the middle stage of life as contributing to a person's risk of developing dementia later were hearing loss, very strongly associated with risk of dementia later. And the more hearing loss you have, the greater your risk of developing dementia later in life. So that's relatively easy to get sorted, right? Go and get your hearing tested and get a hearing aid if you need to. High LDL cholesterol was associated with increased dementia risk, and it's probably fairly obvious there. So oxidized cholesterol is quite damaging to blood vessels.
Depression. Yeah, and that's controllable, definitely.
Yeah. Mental health specifically, depression was associated with a 3% increase in developing dementia later in life. And I guess the thinking there is that people who suffer from depression tend to go into a smaller world, so they're not communicating as much, they're not kind of living their life as much as they should, perhaps not taking care of their diet as much as they should.
Yeah, maybe they're not getting the stimulus to the brain that they would otherwise. And that sounds like the hearing is that way, and maybe the social isolation, depression is the same sort of thing. It's like you're not using that muscle, and so it goes away.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. You mentioned traumatic brain injury. That actually, TBIs are associated with a 3% increase in risk.
Ouch.
In developing dementia later. And that seems to be related to vascular damage in the brain. So, you know, I think about all those kids out there playing rugby. In New Zealand, we're a massive rugby culture. Even a single knock to the head actually increases one's risk of developing dementia later.
Yeah. And I got some of mine that way. I'll just respond to that last bit. I played football, American football, when I was a kid, and I got knocked out, actually unconscious, even with a helmet on, one time for sure. But all of my other ones were, you know, as an adult and doing active things, but and often not wearing a helmet. But a lot of people listening here are cyclists. And if you are riding a bike, then you are crashing your bike. That is just inevitable. And so people have got to be wearing helmets. But even people who, all of the concussions that I got crashing my bike were with a helmet on. So, you know, spend more, get a really great helmet, and then don't crash. I don't know what else to say because I crashed a lot, but protect your brain.
I think don't crash is a great message, followed closely by wear a really good helmet.
Yeah.
And you know, follow up to that is when you have a concussion or a brain knock, you do actually need to rest afterwards.
Don't get another concussion right away, huh?
Oh, no, don't do that. Let your brain give you – most of the recovery happens in the first three-month period. There'll be more recovery after that, but the recovery slows down significantly. So, you know, if you're feeling – fatigued after a head knock, really listen to your body and rest, because that's your body repairing itself and your brain really needs that time to do that. I feel like I'm giving a lecture right now.
That's what we're here for.
I was really interested to see physical inactivity. They identified only contributing a 2% increased risk to developing dementia later in life. I thought it would be much higher than that. You know, they say that physical inactivity is the new smoking. We're all sitting around our desk doing these desk jobs, pooling blood down in our ankles. It's just really no good.
Yeah, but the lack of activity is also going to contribute to all of these other factors. You know, you're going to get high blood pressure and, you know, all these other things. So anyway, nobody here listening to this episode is sedentary, so we don't have to worry about that one.
Yeah. Obvious ones like smoking, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, excessive alcohol. That last one, I thought that's actually interesting. So they define excessive alcohol as more than 3 units per day.
Hmm.
That is a lot. That's a lot per day, I thought.
There were times in my life where that was a normal amount, so I'm not going to cast aspersions on people who like that as a part of their life. But hey, it's affecting your brain health, so you know, you pay your money, you take your chances.
Yeah. The thing about alcohol, ethanol, you know, it's a small molecule. It gets into the brain really easily, diffuses across everywhere, all the bits of your body really easily, and it is actually a neurotoxin. So there you go; it kills your brain cells.
And it wrecks my sleep too. So there's lots of reasons to not imbibe.
It's so nice having a glass of wine, isn't it?
Very tempting.
Then the report went on to look at, you know, there were 3 factors identified later in life, so over the age of 65. Social isolation, air pollution, and visual loss were the 3 identified later in life. And social isolation really comes back to what we were talking about before, Joe, cognitive reserve. And, you know, if you're not communicating with other humans, that's a real loss of sensory input. Because, you know, as humans, we're so finely tuned to read each other, and it's such a rich experience speaking with and looking at another human, right? We're taking in the whole thing, all the body language, every nuance of language that's coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Stance, height, even the smell of another human. It is like an intensely enriching experience for our brain, right?
Oh, yeah.
All the senses are turned on because we're so, I don't know, it's like fight, flight, that should I be fearful of this person? Are they a friend? Are they a foe? Are they a mating pair? You know, when you're in your earlier part of life, right, your brain is very, very attuned. It's part of survival.
And we're so good at it, we don't even know how cognitively demanding it is. We're born for that. But, you know, just like what we're doing here, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm trying to understand what you're saying. And at the same time, I'm trying to think of, well, what's my next question going to be? And so it's like my brain is really working pretty hard.
Yeah, your job is harder than mine. You've got to think of the questions. I can just talk. What I find really interesting about that social isolation aspect, the new research coming out that shows even the micro interactions that you might have on the daily, for example, with people at the supermarket checkout or someone making your coffee or in a restaurant or whatever, even those micro interactions count as, you know, social connectedness. So don't discount them. And perhaps, you know, my advice there would be to put yourself in someone else's shoes. So if you see an older person, say, hey, how's it going? How's your day? Can I help you with your groceries? I just think that's so, it's good for them. It's good for us. It's good for everyone to feel more connected and less isolated. Yeah. And it turns out it reduces your risk of developing dementia. So it's a win-win-win.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's the 14 modifiable risk factors. If you addressed all of those issues in your life, that adds up to a total 45% modifiable risk, which I think is phenomenal given, you know, the aging population we have and the burden of disease we have with dementia. We talked a bit about cognitive reserve and the connections between brains, brain cells, and the importance of, you know, education and connecting and smelling and seeing and hearing and all those things. There's also a big element of these factors reducing stress and inflammation in the brain, also reducing the buildup of the pathology that often happens with particularly Alzheimer's disease. So you get these plaques and tangles, and to clear those out, you need good blood flow. So many of those factors also feed into the health of the blood vessels in your brain, the vascular health. So all together, sort of what we're doing is we're calming down the brain, so we're reducing inflammation, we've got good enough blood flow to keep the brain cells healthy, we're stimulating our brain cells, and we're also getting enough sleep to clear out the early stages of brain pathology when they start, and sleep is very, very important for that. But although not identified as one of the risk factors in the paper. But yeah, as I said, this type of approach to data, meta-analysis, tends to only pick up the big, big trends. It doesn't pick up the smaller stuff. And sleep's one of the ones that's not in there, and neither is diet. But I'd be really quite keen to talk about some of the research around diet, yeah, specifically in brain health.
Let's do that. But first, I got to talk about sleep, because everybody walks around after a bad night's sleep thinking, I'm killing myself. You know, my brain is dying. You know, I didn't get my lymphatic system up to snuff last night. And so, you know, all the bad things are still in there and none of the good things got in there. Why do you think, you even said that sedentary behavior was only like a 2% added to the risk? Sleep must have been less. It didn't even rank. How could sleep not be one of the big ones? What do you think?
Yeah, it's probably just not researched enough, I would think. I would think that would be the reason. I mean, there is a bit of research around sleep and kind of brain protection, certainly a bit around sleep and eating habits and sleep and mental health. I would say there's just not enough data to stick it in that big report. But, you know, certainly any research you look that has looked at sleep and its impact on the brain clearly shows that getting a good night's sleep is very, very important. So,
yeah, yeah. And you feel better too.
A fairly active listener base, Joe, and getting physical activity every day is probably one of the most important things you can do for a good night's sleep, as well as all the other things. I'm no expert in sleep. I'm a busy CEO and a mother of two children, so sleep sometimes is challenging for me. But, you know, I do my best to get exercise every day. I do my best to have a, you know, what I call my close down routine of skincare, and try to do a few yoga stretches before I go to bed as my way of detaching from the busy part of the day and getting into the restful part of the day. So I do try to be quite disciplined on that, and I would encourage people to try to be quite disciplined around their sleep routine.
Yeah. And I've had episodes on sleep recently, and it's top of my list. So I'm sure that people listening will appreciate the importance of sleep, even if it didn't make the top 14 things. Before we jump into like stuff we could do, like diet, I would like to dive a little bit into this question of how can a person like me, everybody listening, evaluate for themselves their risk of getting it? I mean, I've heard things like something terrible, like half of people will get it eventually. You know, if they just live long enough, they're going to get it. And so maybe we're not talking about avoiding it altogether, but the later it comes on, and maybe it's been coming on since I was 45, you know, or whatever it was that you said, and I haven't noticed it. That's what I want. I want to not notice it. I want it to stay low enough that I don't notice it and nobody notices it, I guess is probably the better way to put it. But how would a person like me kind of evaluate my risk? What would the different things to consider to kind of put my personal scorecard together for me to say, oh, this is my top priority. I really have got to do all of the things that I can possibly do on this one. Or, yeah, I think I'm probably solid here. This can be a lower priority. I've got other things that I've got to work on. And I don't mean out of laziness, but just, you know, there's only 7 days a week and 24 hours in a day, and people have to go to work and raise their children and do whatever the things that you do as well. So what do you think? How do I put my personal scorecard together on this?
Actually, there's a really good resource on a website called Food for the Brain Foundation. So that's in the UK. Food for the Brain Organization, I think it's called. So it's a UK-based organization that I've been watching with great interest. So they offer testing services. So their particular thing is around looking at B vitamin status and the level of an amino acid in your body called homocysteine, which we can talk about if you like. But they also have a really great tool on their website where you can plug in all your lifestyle things and it will come back at you and say, hey, Joe, you need to connect more. Hey, Joe, you're doing plenty of exercise, so that's all good. You probably need to reduce your drinking. It will come back and tell you where your risk factors are, and they encourage you to do it regularly so you can kind of track your progress.
That sounds great.
They're also trying to sell you test kits and things.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's worth doing, you know, if you really want to know.
Yeah.
Do they also like ask you about like your APOE4 or APOE status, history of concussions and things like that?
Not the genetic aspect, they don't. So they're all about, you know, modifiable risk factors. Is concussion in there? I believe it is.
Okay. And family history, maybe? Now, you can't modify family history, but you can at least know, you know. I mean, for me, my family history is kind of complicated because on my mom's side of the family, they live forever and they don't get dementia. And on my dad's side of the family, they die young and they have dementia when they're dead. So, you know, I don't know which path I'm going down, but I would call that a risk factor. I've got a chance of that being part of my future. But, you know, somebody who's like everybody in their family, it comes on in their 60s. Okay, well, you know, that would be a big thing to pay attention to. What do you think?
Yeah, like that, the family history aspect. So ruling out, you know, APOE, but just the family history aspect is actually quite a weak indicator of your own risk of developing dementia. It does increase your risk, but not as much as you think. It's quite a low
indicator.
So it seems to be, you know, lifestyle factors, the way you live your life right from the get-go seems to be more important.
So it's kind of cumulative how I've lived my life as opposed to what I've been doing the last 10 years?
That's all cumulative. Yeah, it's all cumulative. I worry that, you know, if we put the message out there that it's what you did 20 years ago or in your early life, then people think, oh, there's nothing I can do. That's not true. Every day that goes by, you know, you're accumulating free radicals in your brain and inflammation in your brain and your body and fat in places it shouldn't be and all that sort of stuff. So my message is there's no time like today to make those positive changes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the best time to make the change was yesterday, but since you can't, today.
Today, exactly. Yeah, and I think of that myself a lot on the exercise front. I love the research that shows that, you know, even 15 minutes a day of brisk walking makes a difference. So yeah. For me, I don't always have time for an extended workout, but I do have time for 15 minutes of, you know, quite fast walking. So I make that my absolute bare minimum. And I think everyone can do that, right, irrespective of how busy you are. And if you can't walk for whatever reason, maybe you're too overweight or you've got something wrong with your body or whatever, there are chair workouts too that can get your heart rate up. So get your heart rate up, get your muscles moving as much as you can. I know you've got a fit audience. They're probably thinking, what the heck, 15 minutes, that's nothing. It is very minimal, right? But for some people, that's as good as it gets some days.
Well, I've heard that the biggest reductions in the risk of dementia come from the people who are doing everything the worst possible way, and then they start making improvements and they have dramatic reductions in their risk. So for people who are, you know, pretty healthy and pretty active, then doing more is probably going to be good, but it's not going to have dramatic effects. But let me ask you, it always comes up in conversations about, can you do too much physical activity? You know, if I'm running, you know, 100-mile runs every week, am I damaging, you know, am I increasing my chance of hurting my brain from doing too much exercise or too much hard exercise or anything like that?
Short answer, yes. Really interesting study out recently that showed that ultra marathon runners actually start eating into the outside sheath of their neurons called the myelin sheath. They actually start eating their own brain tissue because their brains are so starved of energy.
Terrible.
Crazy, right? So if they had enough recovery, their brains made a full recovery. If they kept hammering it, as you said, you know, week after week, starving their brain of nutrients and energy, you're actually going to do lasting damage. So, yes, you can overdo it. Now, I just want to preface that by saying I'm really no exercise physician. I'm not an exercise scientist or anything like that. I read that study from the perspective of being a neuroscientist, and I was like, holy heck, that is really hardcore.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, but that's probably, I mean, an ultra marathoner is a really on the edge of the possibilities of things. I've never done anything like that. I would never do anything like that. So anyway, I don't think that for a normal active person, that would be a reason to do less.
That's right. For a normal active person, so I guess when you exercise, you actually generate quite a lot of free radicals, right? So they are species that generate a bit of damage in cells. Hmm. And that's okay. Cells are cells in your body, not so much in your brain, but cells in your body are supposed to die and turn over and be replaced. That's actually quite healthy. Getting the right nutrition in after exercise to reduce down that oxidative stress is quite important. So, you know, I just love that on the sports field, chopped up oranges are offered to kids. Awesome. Vitamin C is one of the best antioxidants there is. So eat some colorful fruit when you've finished your workout. That would be my message.
Okay. Before we move into the what can we do and diet, which you're anxious to get to, is family history is not really a big deal, especially if your lifestyle has been different from the people in your family who did have dementia. You know, maybe they smoked and they drank a lot and they, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're doing everything right, then maybe it doesn't matter to you. But your own history could matter, you know, like head injuries. I've had concussions or maybe worse head injuries that don't quite heal perfectly. Maybe viral things. I mean, I've been hearing people who have had COVID, a long COVID, what they have is brain fog, which is kind of, you know, it's like an energy deficit that their brain is not working quite right anymore. And I don't know if that's vascular or what. But anyway, so you've got people have a personal history of stuff going wrong. And, you know, that I think that sort of makes your score worse for understanding your risk. At least that's how I would interpret it. Maybe you've had a long history of having high blood pressure or high cholesterol or high blood sugar. Maybe you've got type 2 diabetes and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then if you've, you know, not had a challenging career and a lot of education and you didn't build up cognitive reserve earlier in your life, these would seem to me that they would add up to a, hey, you really have got to get on this, you know, while you can still decide to do it. Now is the time. But do you think so?
Now is the time. And I think, you know, Joe, you're talking about your listeners are fairly physically fit bunch, which is awesome. Yeah. And whether there's more they can do physically to get better protection from dementia later in life, I think the answer probably lies in doing something different, right? So what happens when we're in the middle age of our lives is we get into these routines and you do it with exercise, you do it with where you do your shopping, you do it with the type of food you cook, your friends you have, the places you visit. I would challenge people who are already doing quite a lot of good stuff in terms of physical activity and diet to do something different in your life.
So not more of the good stuff that you're already doing, but do new good things.
Yeah, that's right. So join a new club or group or get a new interest. I think that, so for me, that's one of the most important things. And I recently just joined a Waka Ama group. So that's like a traditional Maori canoe rowing group here in New Zealand that I go out on a Sunday morning. It's not something I've ever done before, and it's really interesting. It's a whole technique you got to learn. You're working in a team and all of that. Really good, very social as well. But, yeah, there's even small stuff you can do as well, and there's two things I like to put out there to people. One, supermarket shopping, boring, something we all do every week, probably multiple times a week. Go to a different supermarket, or if you don't want to do that, start your supermarket shop at the other end. So in New Zealand, it's always the fruit and veg aisle first, and then you go through, blah, 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 you go to your checkout. Start at the other end and go backwards and see how your brain copes with that. It is challenging mentally. The other one is sit in a different spot. We're such creatures of routine, right? Because we want to kind of reduce the complexity of our daily. And so when you sit down to watch a bit of Netflix or whatever, you probably always sit in the same spot.
I bet that's right.
Sit somewhere else. Boot your kids out. Boot your partner out of their favorite spot and sit there. Even those small changes challenge your brain. Don't get comfortable don't always sit in the same spot. Sit somewhere else. Sit on the ground and stretch your hamstrings instead.
Fantastic. And another routine that I get into that causes me trouble is when I go to work, I always go the same way every single time. And that groove gets so deep that sometimes on the weekend I get in my car and I start going to work. Like, what am I doing?
Yeah. Okay. You need to go a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Okay. So, so let's move into the, what can we do? And why don't you start with diet?
Yeah. Diet's an interesting one. So there's a really interesting diet study out there called the MIND diet. It's a combination of the very well-known Mediterranean diet and another diet called the DASH diet, which is about reducing blood pressure. So the MIND diet is a combination of those two diets together. It came about from a study that went over the course of 4.5 years. It looked at 923 people, so decent study size. And what it found that was that those who had the best adherence to the diet had 53% less development of dementia, and even those who had a sort of moderate adherence to the diet had about a 35% risk of developing dementia.
And what was the time frame that they were studying?
4.5 years.
So in 4.5 years, they had these big reductions. Imagine how much of a reduction it is if it went even longer.
Absolutely. No, really interesting. And also much slower, just cognitive decline. So quite irrespective of actually developing, you know, a disease state, there's a certain amount of cognitive decline that happens over 4.5 years when you're over the age of 65 anyway.
Right, right.
Significant slowing in cognitive decline as well. So the, okay. Yeah, the MIND diet is, it's really not rocket science. That's what I love about it. It's green leafy veg at least 6 times a week. Other veg, nuts every day, berries, again, that comes back to the antioxidant, you know, function we spoke about before. Right. Plenty of legumes and whole grains. I think carbs get such a bad rap these days, people forget that there's lots of good stuff in whole grains, right? B vitamins. Mm-hmm. Oily fish at least once a week. So there's a lot of research around the benefits of omega-3s for brain health. Poultry at least 2 times a week, olive oil as your primary cooking oil if you're using seed oils. I know that's a hot topic in the US right now, and maybe we don't want to go there, but olive oil as your primary cooking oil.
Sounds good.
And just as importantly, things to exclude, red meat, also hot topic I know in your country, margarine. They also excluded cheese. Pastries and sweets and fried and fast food. So now that cheese aspect, I'm just not sure about that personally because I'm such a cheese lover, but that is what the diet says. And, you know, most of that is just not rocket science, right? It's the good stuff that we already know about. And I think that's what I love about this diet. It's also going to benefit all just your overall health status, probably your weight as well.
Right.
So, yeah, that I think to me is the most powerful study I've seen linking diet to improved health outcomes later. So omega-3s are a really interesting one. Omega-3s are very strongly linked to brain health, not specifically, you know, dementia per se, but just brain health and brain function. It's important to get omega-3. So I do take omega-3s most days.
You take a supplement?
Supplement, yep. I take a high-dose DHA, yep.
And so in like a fish oil source versus like an algae?
I take a fish oil source, but I think the algae ones are pretty good. I just haven't come across a brand here in New Zealand that I'm familiar with in the algae DHA space. But I'm sure there are good ones out there. When it comes to supplements, I sort of stick to brands that I am familiar with and trust.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, I take DHA most days, and I take vitamin D over the winter as well, which it is here in New Zealand right now. I don't bother with it in summer because I just get outside. But vitamin D is very important for everything, you know, bones, immunity, brain, the lot.
Great.
And I take another one called cyclic glycine proline, CGP. So that's an interesting dipeptide. It's a cyclic dipeptide. So glycine and proline are amino acids. and that when they're put together under certain conditions, they cyclize, and it's what it does. It crosses the blood-brain barrier, and it helps repair and grow capillaries in the brain. So that's a really good brain supplement, and that's the company that I'm the CEO of.
Well, we're going to hear more about that. That's great. I know that proline and glycine are prominent in collagen, but I think you're saying that this is a different kind of protein combination of amino acids that is not normally in a collagen. So to get this, you would have to take something else?
Yeah, so we have developed a manufacturing process that combines a specific type of collagen together with New Zealand black currant and puts them through a heat process, which is what helps to create the cyclic glycine proline. So without a specific amount and duration of heat, you won't get the cyclization.
And what does that mean? I don't know what cyclization means. Does it mean that it gets broken down and digested in your stomach and it doesn't get, as a peptide, it doesn't get into your bloodstream so that it can't get into your brain?
No. So with collagen, most people tend to buy hydrolyzed collagen. So what that means is it's just been chopped up into fragments, a bit of a combination of peptides and amino acids, and that makes it absorb better. So to take two of those amino acids, you've got to mash them together under heat and even better under pressure to get them into a different chemical structure, which is just called a cyclic chemical structure. And all it means is it's just different to bog standard amino acids, and it has its own function in the body. So CGP, and there's lots of different cyclic peptides, CGP is one of them. What's really interesting about CGP is it's in all of our brains and bodies as a breakdown product of a hormone called IGF-1. So this is already known, and the amount of IGF-1 in our systems, or the activity of it anyway, goes down as we age. And so by taking CGP orally in a capsule form, which is what our company makes, you help to regulate the activity of IGF-1. And the main great benefit there is it stimulates the growth and repair of capillaries. So, you know, we talked quite a bit about all the things in the brain that are going on to protect the brain later in life. Capillary health and blood flow is one of the very, very important things.
Okay, well, that's interesting. We're running short of time. I would like to understand if there are other things. Say the name of your product again, because that one sounds like a good one.
CGP Max. That's our brand name.
CGP Max. Okay, and I'll put a link to your company and this product in the show notes. But what other things, like you mentioned omega-3s, and I think that rather than like omega-3s that are in like walnuts, you're focusing on EPA and DHA, which you're going to get in a fish oil or maybe an algae oil. And you are focusing particularly on the DHA, but you know, what other things? Okay, vitamin D, you said. Is there anything else that people could take that would be, you know, good for the brain? I've kind of got a long list here. People have talked about lion's mane being like a nootropic.
Oh, yes.
Methylene blue, you know, for like a re-energizing your mitochondria, things like that.
Yeah, look, there's a plethora out there, isn't there, of supplements that you could take. Look, lion's mane I know is very good as a nootropic, so getting your brain firing on all cylinders when you need it to, like if you've got a tough day at work or an exam or something like that. Personally, I would not take a nootropic long-term myself because the way they work generally is to stimulate the release of chemicals in the brain called neurotransmitters, and you just don't really want to do that on an ongoing, permanent basis. So I do not favor nootropics, but that aside, very, very basic B vitamins. So if you do not have enough B vitamins in your diet, so you get B vitamins from poultry, meat, and some types of veggies. So if you're a person who's not really eating whole foods, right, you're eating too much crap, you're probably not getting enough B vitamins. And B vitamins are very, very important for lowering a toxic amino acid in our body and brain called homocysteine.
Yeah, go into that a little bit.
Our homocysteine goes up, and that is a very, very strong and reliable indicator of both cardiovascular risk and brain health risk. So I eat a reasonably good diet. I don't need to take B vitamins. If you have a bit of a crap diet, get yourself a B vitamin supplement.
Or eat a better diet.
Or eat a better diet, yeah. You can actually ask your doctor for a homocysteine test to determine where your levels are at, and that to me is one of the strongest indicators of brain health and also just diet in general. So I did that. Mine was fine, and I was really pleased.
Well, congratulations to your good eating. Let me ask you about caffeine. I mean, everybody, including myself until recently, because I quit caffeine here recently, but everybody just about is using caffeine to help their brain, right? They're tired and they can't think straight, and so they have some caffeine and it kind of makes them more alert. There are, you know, even athletic performance benefits from caffeine. Caffeine seems to be like, there's nothing bad about it unless you have too much for your own physiology and then you're not sleeping well and now you've really done yourself some harm. But is there any research on caffeine and brain health?
Yeah, caffeine intake is associated with lower risk of developing some specific neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's.
Mm.
It's also associated with better performance on tests and things. You know, it just keeps you a bit more alert, keeps your brain cells firing. You know, caffeine, we consume caffeine in lots of different ways, and I'd be interested to look into this more because there's heavily processed coffee, right? But then there's fairly unprocessed coffee beans just ground up and made into a cup of coffee. So mm-hmm. I don't know if the research applies to intake of all different forms of coffee, you know, heavily industrially processed, freeze-dried.
So it could be the polyphenols, as much as it's the caffeine.
Yeah, that's right. So coffee beans ground up and made into a coffee is actually pretty high in polyphenols. So coming back to that antioxidant aspect we spoke about briefly. I am a big fan of caffeine. I love it. And it makes me feel happy as a neuroscientist knowing that it's also doing good stuff for my brain. But as you say, don't go into excess. But I think excess, according to the research, is actually quite high. It's like more than five cups a day is bad for you.
I see. Well, for me, I was struggling with my sleep, and I was just experimenting to see if I cut out all the caffeine, would it make any difference? And it did. And I was not drinking a lot of coffee. I was drinking essentially no coffee. I was drinking green tea, but I was drinking a lot of green tea, and it took like a month for the caffeine to be out. And maybe it wasn't all just the caffeine getting out, but my withdrawals took a month to go away. So I'm reluctant to jump back in with both feet, but just yesterday I had to take a certification exam and I had some caffeine to perform my best on that test and I passed. So thanks to the caffeine, but then last night I slept terrible. So I think I'm keeping the caffeine out for a bit longer.
Yeah, it sounds like you're quite sensitive to it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So that's just me. All right. Well, so what else can we tell people and tell us a little more about how we find your company and you online?
What else can we tell people? Gosh, I feel like we've covered the bases actually.
Okay, good.
You know, get healthy, not just for your body, but for your brain as well.
Yeah. Protect your noggin.
Protect your noggin. Look after the elderly in your life. Go have a chat to them. Get them out for a walk. All of that. Yeah. So I'm the CEO of a company called the CGP Lab. We're based here in New Zealand. We were founded in 2020 to commercialize the molecule I spoke about previously called cyclic glycine proline, or CGP for short. And CGP is phenomenal for brain health. And particularly sort of protecting and rebuilding capillaries, which we need from about middle age on. We're online. Our website is called cgpmax.com. I myself am on LinkedIn, so you can look me up. I'd love to connect if you want to, chat about brain health or anything else. And yeah, that's pretty much us.
All right. Well, that's really great, Amanda. Thank you. I'll get all that in the show notes so people who were driving or whatever and not taking notes, they can just go to the show notes and then click on links, and they can look all that stuff up. Thank you very much.
Been so great chatting, Joe. I think we've really covered the bases. I loved it. Thank you.
Yeah. I have to say that I'm disappointed that I have never been able to visit New Zealand. It's still on my list. It just looks like such an amazing, beautiful place. So congratulations that that's where you get to live.
Yeah, thank you. It is very nice.
All right, Amanda. You have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Amanda Wiggins. You can find more information about Amanda and dementia in the show notes.